Clerk Flight is going to introduce Sasha. So
thank you.
It's a pleasure to do this and an honor to do this also, because I like to think that Sasha and I grew up together. We almost did. I'm a great deal older, obviously, than Sasha. But I studied painting with Sasha's father, Sam Feinstein. And for a long time in the 1960s in New York City, Sasha and I lived in the same house. And we shared and continue to share certain very not just individual memories, but certain very solid and special interests. I'm thinking particularly, actually, of not only of writing, but I'm thinking of jazz. I remember early on that when I was still living in New York, I left New York, by the way, in 1971 and moved to Gloucester. But I used to recommend records to Sasha, and he now recommends records to me. He recommended one just earlier today, and I'm certainly going to get it. That's a special kind of connection that we both share. Our passion for and our love for jazz, and it certainly goes through quite obviously in a great deal of Sasha's work, but in my painting, which is I don't paint pictures of jazz musicians, but the way that I work, what I want my paintings to do, as I said once, I work to make my paintings swing. And I'm not going to go into that, because that has to do with my painting, not Sasha's. But I find that Sasha's work, while in many ways it's formal, also swings. And I'm skating on very thin ice here, because I'm not a musician and I'm not a poet. But so I'm gonna stop and introduce Sasha.
Thank you so very much, Thorpe. It's so amazing to be here with some of my oldest and dearest friends, some of my dearest, my favorite former student. I have graduate school friends. I'm going to be reading from a relatively recent book of poems and from a newly finished manuscript of personal essays, and in the audience is one of my absolute favorite poets on the planet and one of my absolute favorite essayists on the planet. So this is more than just an honor. This is sort of like a bona fide nightmare. This book, Ajanta's Ledge, the title poem was inspired by a trip to India, and the title poem is quite long, and because there's a bed over here, I'm afraid people would sleep if I read it. So I'm going to read a much shorter poem inspired by that trip. It's called The Taj. Like most last breath stories, this one's a good lie. How Mumtaz Mahal, still bleeding from childbirth, pulled Shah Jahan to her mouth, begged for a temple in her memory. How he based the dome on the curve of her breast. How, when she dies, he turns gray overnight. We know she's entombed 22 years later, that he's deposed by his son, and, every guide will tell you this, imprisoned in Agra Fort, so he'll die overlooking the Taj. It's a death sentence, too, for the dream of a bridge and a perfect shadow in black marble. Instead, and this fact's true as death, he's buried beside his wife, breaking absolute symmetry for another form of perfection. Even in India, Our greatest love stories are never quite enough. This is a poem for the poet Bill Matthews, who was as good at making poems as he was bad at staying in relationships. It's called, but I miss him very much. He was one of the greatest conversationalists I've ever known. It's Matthews in Smoke. All the better that he can walk from his narrow apartment to the club, now called Smoke, then Augie's, half the room on bar stools beneath an olive-green mural of alcoholics, so polymorphically depressing, Bill has to respond. Professors emeritus. We're in a neighborhood of trouble. I'm ducking an old girlfriend. He's ducking a new one. So when the dour waitress returns with bad wine and cheap scotch, we skip a toast that would translate to, "Good night, night." We're here mainly out of convenience, so it's something of a shock when a chunky tenor player from Chicago, just 21, saturates the room with a thick, wet Dexter Gordon tone. In 2 years, he'll be known, second place in the Monk contest, the best near win in jazz history. But now he's swinging Bewitched as a waltz, the lyrics, "I'm wild again, beguiled again," spun in thirds across the hi-hat's steady shimmer. The kid's making notice. And Bill forsakes witty references, unveiled allusions, triumphant alliterative punchlines. He leaves them all in the bar's tip gutter. Tonight it's the real thing. Music putting language not to shame exactly, nor in its place. Tonight, language burns faster than Bill's cigarettes. Tonight, it's all holy shit and oh yeah. I'm going to read from a series of sonnets, poems called Everything Happens to Me. And that sounds very narcissistic. It's not, actually. It's after the tune. It's actually Everything Happens to Me, 1965. And they're all dramatic monologues by famous alto saxophonists from that year. I'll read a few of them. Marion Brown at the Star Ledger offices, Newark. My best year, yeah. I've been in the studio a lot, but I don't sing. Listen, my brother, if you're going to cut the white reporters, do your homework. What'd your boss tell you, that I was a woman? I just made a quartet album, my first as leader. Recorded with Train earlier this year. What's that? C-O-L-T-R-A-N-E. Archie Shepp's Fire Music, that was very intense. We played Malcolm, Semper Malcolm, as Funeral, for Evers, Medgar Evers. It was the middle of February. We sure felt it. Then they wasted Brother Malcolm, though that was 5 long days later. Sonny Chris at Shelley's Manhole, Hollywood. Next day I got all these telephone calls. You okay? You see all that shit last night? Watts. Never would have imagined it. It's like I explained to Hampton Hawes. I saw the flames, grabbed a fifth of J&B, a folding chair, took him out to the lawn, got comfortable, felt like Nero. By dawn, the sky was all speckled in a blackish green, like, I don't know, like Bessie's Blues or the cargo hold of some terrible slave ship. But it was funny, too. What a sight. I just recorded with Hawes back in June. When Sonny gets blue, the masquerade is over. Boy, did we get that right. Lee Konitz at Johanna Shava Stadium, Stockholm. Of course it's great to play with Bill Evans. And yeah, I mean, he's still grieving. When someone's so gifted and young, Scotty just made 25, and he's your left hand, and then he's gone in a crash, you question if you'll ever sound right again, if you'll be a soul without a soulmate. Life's cruel. But what about this bass player? Exceptional timing. Trust me if you can't hear it. This Dane's beautiful. Understand? You've got to feel the present and think of the future. This kid's 19, for Christ's sake. Write down his name. Niels Henning Ørsted Pedersen. Hey, Bill, what do you call an O with a slash through it? Jackie McLean and Rudy Van Gelder's studio, Englewood Cliffs. No, 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 no. 4 bars, 10 beats, everybody in unison, horns, drums, everybody. And then the pickup. Here, bracket those 2 bars, 2 sets of quintuplets. What? Look, it's not one. It's not one. Jack, tell Larry and Larry to shut up. Man, it's not one person's fault. You all got that? Okay? We'll just do another damn take. The man's going to take everything anyway, right? You're fighting like you're fighting for justice instead of focusing on the matter at hand. This composition, right? Okay. Quiet. Jackknife. Take 11. Jesus, Charles. Why'd you write such a motherfucker? I'll read one last one. Art Pepper in the exercise yard of San Quentin State Prison. Stupid goddamn parole violation. That's all, or at least the most of it. I was at a local club, my first gig after getting out, felt real edgy. Then a waitress leans down and says, "There's fuzz in this place." And then I see them staring into my horn. Everything happens to me. You know the tune? Your answer was goodbye. There was even postage due. We played that beautifully. Long set, no breaks. I think we played for almost 2 hours without a single break. But I knew they'd wait me out, so finally I said thanks and stepped off the stand into the applause. Here's one that Stephen Dunn accepted for Night Sun. It may not be a good poem, but I think it may be the only poem published dedicated to the serial number of a saxophone. It's 464842, in case you're taking notes and all that. It's called After You've Gone. They forged my horn in 25, these craftsmen I'll never know, who sweated evenings by fires that blazed their busy town into the topographical map of American music, Elkhart, Indiana. This soprano sax, a low-pitched Martin, changed hands how many times in the 55 years before my father and his 2 brothers purchased the saxophone from me. It's not that I desire to live in Yeats's Byzantine dream, reborn as a golden bell fashioned to keep a drowsy audience awake. But today I'm whistling tunes I'm sure the artisans hummed while they steadied their hands to imprint this dazzling filigree and the final brand, a serial number, to remind each generation how many musicians the horn outlives. Federico Garcia Lorca once said this marvelous thing. He said, "The only things that the United States has given to the world are skyscrapers, jazz, and cocktails. That is all." No. This is called Small's Paradise, 1929. You'd be right to imagine Lorca challenging the gramophone's needle, skittering across the 78. Lorca leaping to Ellington. Black and tan fantasy. When he arrives in Manhattan, how can we not picture him dancing with the dancers? You'd be right to love his love of Spanish passion, now giving into Charlie Johnson's Paradise Band at Smalls, windowless and surreal on 2294 and a half 7th Ave, just a block and a basement away from the Cotton Club's majesty and glitz. Beneath the streets, the tables rock and rattle to George Stafford's snare, to Brock-like trumpet lines, Sidney de Paris battling Jabbo Smith, spotlit saxophones, wild man blues. It's easy, isn't it, to admire Federico at 31, slicked hair and tailored suit, shirt unbuttoned beneath his chin as he spins a black woman he'll later describe as an African exile. I protested to see so much flesh stolen from paradise. Oh, the immigrant's cultural compromise. But for now, what joy to be at the center of this gorgeous, fluid world, el mundo ondulando. You'd be right to imagine all that, though you'd be exactly wrong. To be true to history, hypnotize his blazing spirit, lower his head, place his arms at his side, close his eyes, have him whisper el ritmo. Let him wander while he sits, silently lost in the jazz club's landscape, where leopards purr and curl, where the moon broods in the wet bell of a trombone's metallic throat. I'm going to move now to an essay from my most recent manuscript. This is called, the manuscript is called Wreckage, and it's subtitled Essays on My Father's Art and Junk. And some of you are laughing because you knew my father, who was, to be fair, a really brilliant painter and a tremendous teacher. One of the most inspiring artists I've ever known, that's for sure. But he was also just a control freak and a hoarder beyond anything you can imagine. I mean, the show on TV, that's child's play, man. I mean, it's really... So these essays, what they try to do is they keep going back to this theme of someone who's trying to constantly create while at the same time bringing everything down around him, that kind of rising and falling. And this chapter is called... It's late in the book, so it's probably a stupid part to read, but I think it holds it together enough. It's called Boats and Starships. In August of 1988, I went fishing with my father for the first time. I initiated the outing because I had news that required coaxing, and I thought deserved a bit of ceremony. Marlon and I had gotten engaged that winter. We'd now set a date for the following summer, and I wanted to invite him to attend. It would be a traditional Indian wedding, held in her home country, Singapore. He was my only living parent, and a snub would be culturally shameful. But how could I convince him to travel? I decided to break the news during a father and son outing, one unlike anything we'd experienced. In retrospect, I realized the absurdity of this idea, one that forced an idealized American scenario onto a decidedly unusual family dynamic. But during my undergraduate years, I became completely enamored of a Hemingway-esque professor who idealized what, quote, real men should do. In that spirit, I decided we would bond, man to man, talking love, marriage, and futures. I would clean our canoe, revitalize a couple of old rods, and we would fish the mill ponds in Brewster. A grand New England fishing trip. Call me imbecile. The canoe had been purchased in the summer of 77 at a store, not a yard sale. I mention this to emphasize the fact that it was a big deal. That year, my eighth grade class had divided into large groups intended to bring classmates together, various summer camp programs that began in the spring. The most popular, as I recall, was Outward Bound, for which I held a Woody Allen-like contempt. Of the choices, the canoe trip appealed to me the most, but I had little interest in joining a group, despite my mother's prodding. She eagerly nudged me to make more friends, but I was content to be a loner. Finally, my father interceded. Look, with the money that I'd be spending on this trip, we can buy our own canoe. If he had to spend this kind of cash, he could at least save some money in the process, and much more important, end up owning something of value. That June, we left the Goose Hummock shop in Orleans with a bright yellow Merrimack strapped to the roof of our 58 Volvo. It was a beaut, wider than traditional canoes, almost 40 inches, with an interior luxuriously lined with mahogany. The yellow body was fiberglass, not meant for rapids, and so attention had been paid to detail and design, including the attractively caned seats. One could immediately respect the craftsmanship, whether or not one had any inclination for water sports. My mother and I launched the canoe a number of times in nearby Scargo Lake, as well as the mill ponds in Brewster. We never fished from it. We simply paddled out to enjoy gliding by the waterscapes. Our excursions took place that first summer and the next. In 79, her last summer, she suffered back pains, the undiagnosed cancer taking hold. and I don't recall any trips to the mill ponds. In fact, the canoe probably remained dry until 1988, when I invited my father to fish. We drove to the grist mill in Brewster on a morning so clear and crisp, so ideal for my naive intentions, that I considered the day sunblessed. I know my father felt perplexed by the experience because in uncomfortable situations he rattled off bad jokes and one-liners. Nothing I said or observed could get him into the spirit of camaraderie. When I pointed to a perfect arrow of geese overhead, he responded, "Listen to them, they're laughing at us." When I noticed the tip of a largely submerged boat, its shattered remains reminiscent of a storybook pirate scene, he said, "Yeah, those are the last people who tried to fish here." His insistence that we wouldn't catch anything locked into a general philosophy: preach failure, and failure won't disappoint. But I remained an idealistic fool. I wanted our first fishing experience to feel somewhat spiritual, primal, father and son, mysterious water. I wanted a vibe worthy of a serious discussion before I brought up the forthcoming nuptials. I wanted something joyously quiet. I wanted respectful solemnity and a sense of shared experience. "Jesus Christ," my father shouted. "What? Jesus Christ, I've caught a whale." The tip of his rod had plunged into the water, and now he had it in the air while he reeled maniacally. The freshwater rod arced with such strain I feared it might snap. "Could be a bass," I said, grinning in shared victory. "I think you've hooked a bass, Dad." A catch not only disproved his insistent pessimism, it transformed the experience into something, well, more macho. We are men. We hunt food. And I felt no competition. In fact, I badly wanted him to catch something, and a bass was ideal. In the mill ponds, they grew to 10 or 12 pounds. I grabbed the net as the fish's shadow edged towards us. By now, it seemed aware of its captivity. The fight had concluded, and its body moved with my father's steady reeling. I leaned a bit over the side, cautious not to create much of a shift so that we wouldn't tip. Then I netted the prize. This was no bass. Apart from the monkfish that sometimes washed ashore along the bay, it was the ugliest sea creature I've ever seen. As homely and brown as Elizabeth Bishop's famous catch in her poem, The Fish, except I saw no heroic features here. "What the hell is that?" my father asked. "Catfish," I said. "We don't want to keep it." "I should hope not." The morning sun eventually heated the water and sent the fish away from their feeding grounds near the shore, so we paddled back. As I recall, I didn't broach the wedding topic until we'd reached land amen, the canoe strapped to the car, the failed experiment blessedly over. When I told him of our plans, he said everything sounded fine, but he would not be attending. Not a chance, end of story. And his abrupt, determined negation stunned and saddened me, although I tried not to show emotion or suggest judgment. And then, in a relatively short time, I began to feel liberated in a number of ways. I did not have to concern myself, for example, with his happiness or comfort, and both would be challenged. Singapore is known for its astonishing cuisine, which disinterested him completely, and its museums focus primarily on Southeast Asian culture. In 1989, at least, the country didn't own any paintings by Western masters. Humidity drenches your body as soon as you step outside the airport. He would have been bored and steamed. Still, it's entertaining to envision him in the temple among the small oil fires and tossed rose petals, following the gestures of our hefty priest, who spoke only in Sanskrit. I also suspect he would have been baffled by the architecture of Indian temples, as I was initially. The entrance to the Sri Viramakaliamman temple where we got married, for example, features the requisite tiled walls with vertical red and white stripes, colors as subtle as an emergency exit. Above the doorway itself rises a masterfully carved pagoda of three-dimensional reliefs in celebration of Kali, who's depicted astride a lion on the largest, lowest tier. But the color choices for these reliefs, treasured gold, blood red, sky blue, make the narratives almost overwhelming for the eyes. And then, above the golden minarets at the pagoda's crest, aesthetically as incongruous as a chunk of kryptonite, the builders affixed a glowing neon ohm sign. My own bewilderment at this melange of architecture caused me to query Marlene's Uncle Kanaga, a renowned art historian in Singapore. What is the thinking behind these choices, I asked, trying to sound sincere and not critical. It means, he said, grinning both at my question and his impending answer, we want everything, we want it all. The Indian architects had united the incongruity of tile, sculpture, and neon through tradition and theme. The incongruity of forms in my father's still lifes, on the other hand, united because of color and movement. One was based on narrative, the other resisted narrative. Both, of course, strove for something spiritual. Kali herself fascinated me because of her oxymoronic nature, healing humanity by ingesting evil. In my favorite wedding photo, we're smiling on a wooden... Sorry. In my favorite wedding photo, we're smiling on a wooden settee beneath her four outstretched arms that each held a golden weapon. The pupils within her huge eyes target the world beneath her, as though ready to scorch the ground with laser vision. Elsewhere in the temple, she's presented with a regal crown and decorated with immense garlands of jasmine, roses, and lush limes, all the while balancing across her lap a corpse with its torso splayed open. Her fangs and wide tongue secure the demon's intestines that hang from her mouth like dead wisteria. My father's absence from the ceremony ended up being far less embarrassing than I had feared. People were told the edited truth, that he was 74 and had a heart condition. They were not told, of course, that neither played a factor in his decision. The day of our canoe trip, he explained with passion how he and his wife had visited Italy earlier that summer, and the trip had totally interfered with his painting schedule, from the planning to the time away to the jet lag upon return. This did not surprise me. He bragged about seeing 14 cities in 13 days. And I'm told he'd spend much of each night pinpointing the itinerary for the next excursion. In a way, he preferred to collect cities rather than to experience them. As a tourist, he replicated a travelator. So he insisted that he would not attend my wedding in Singapore. He'd learned his lesson. Italy had ruined his rhythm. What does that mean exactly, to have one's rhythm ruined? In Rhythms of Vision, The Changing Patterns of Myth and Consciousness, a book my father admired, Lawrence Blair discusses the expansive topic by providing a Whitman-esque embrace of the world. The difference between blue and orange, F-sharp and E-flat, even between a circle and a square, he explains, are differences only in wave motion. To break that wave motion would mean organic collapse, but doesn't his statement imply that we should move with the world? Before reading Rhythms of Vision, I had encountered Lawrence Blair through a TV series called Ring of Fire, an Indonesian odyssey. He and his brother Lorne set out in 1972, quote, looking for a little adventure. They spent 10 years traveling, much of the time battling conditions unimaginable even to seasoned travelers. When they made their initial launch from Singapore, for example, they spent weeks living in a cramped cabin on a Bugis pirate ship, a space barely enough for them to sleep in, and shared it, as Lawrence explains in the film's narration, with five varieties of ants, plus many unidentifiable creatures, quote, all of them seeming to bite. To make us squirm just a bit more, he adds, but the most active are the cockroaches, which at night come out in vast hordes. That's one of the few moments in the series when the brothers highlight hardship. Like so many nature documentaries, Ring of Fire makes us fantasize about firsthand experiences without dwelling on the necessary personal sacrifice. We hear transient lines about, quote, a wet and windless week going nowhere, and easily cast off introductory phrases such as 7 weeks later. But who among us has the time for that kind of travel? And if we did, the patience. The Blairs eventually reached the Indonesian island of Sulawesi, where the rooftops arc toward the heavens. For many years, it was believed that this architecture paid homage to the starships that first brought the Tarajans to their land. "Your anthropologists laugh at us for saying we came from the stars," a high priest explains to the Blair brothers before modifying the oral history. "They do not think we mean the inner stars. The old Tamanas say this crescent moon shape means the bottom arc of a great vertical circle of our lives, the section at which we are all most deeply plunged into matter. It's to remind us that we sweep down from the upper world, slide round the bottom of the circle, and sweep up again. No trouble, if we have any sense." By the time I visited Tanatoraja in 1998, the influence of Christianity had caused a less imaginative interpretation of their architecture. My guide explained that the starships were merely ships, boats that had landed on the shores of Sulawesi, then known as Celebes. I tried to smile approvingly, to be respectful, despite the loss of magic and the disintegration of myth. My disappointment connected to personal pleasure and sentimentality. Myth, albeit Scandinavian myth, inspired many of my mother's artworks, especially her tapestries. The weavings did not depict realistic portraiture as much as their godly presences. She titled a dark, brooding piece Odin, Father of Thor. A more animated work with sea blues and a variety of grays that frame a warmed red center bore the title Loki, after the trickster figure. Much more dramatically red was Sleipnir, named after Thor's enormous horse. With or without the mythic story, and I suppose this holds true as well for Tarajan architecture, the works exude a penetrating dignity. In the summer of 2001, we held a large retrospective of my mother's work at the Cape Museum of Fine Arts, and oh boy, what a show. Weavings and paintings and fabric appliques, woven dresses, exquisite line drawings, carved wooden blocks and textile designs, even children's books under glass. What she accomplished by 47 excited and challenged us all. Equally bewildering for me, however, was a gesture by my father so unexpected I didn't trust his sincerity. He said I could take the show's contents and any other works of hers that we didn't display back with me to Pennsylvania. Let me put this overture in perspective. The year before, my family and I moved to a large Victorian house with high ceilings, large rooms, and unpainted woodwork. It dwarfed our previous home, and suddenly we needed to think about filling spaces. That's when I remembered a large bentwood rocker from my childhood. It had been stored in New York after a house guest, your husband John, broke through the cane seat, and it remained hidden for decades. "I'd like to have it polished and re-caned," I explained to my father. "Can I take it back to Pennsylvania?" He didn't pause even momentarily before shutting down the idea. I tried again, smiling at the absurdity. "It's been stored away, unseen, broken, for years." "No," he repeated, "that's an expensive rocker." So, relinquishing the legacy of my mother's art could hardly have astounded me more. Did he know that he only had 2 years to live? Having taken most of the work from New York City, did he decide the extra space could be filled more with junk? I'll never know. I returned to the Cape that fall when the show closed, having borrowed from our friends John and Deb their Jeep named Mo. And because most of the work could be rolled, I managed to stuff it all in, leaving nothing behind. I also decided to take the canoe, which hadn't felt water since my father landed the catfish. Once again, thinking unrealistically, I imagined family trips along the mighty Susquehanna, our nation's longest unnavigable river. Had the canoe strapped to the Jeep been inverted, tips to the sky, the silhouette would have resembled the Tarajan house. My father played no games with the deal. He applauded my packing skills, and we had a loving goodbye. Ironically, what had caused the greatest amount of anxiety turned out to be the easiest part of the journey. 15 minutes into the trip, while on the highway, the roof strapping began to fail, and the canoe began to swish from side to side. I pulled over and tightened the straps, but 2 minutes later, the canoe once again shifted diagonally in front of my windshield. I followed an off-ramp, found a hardware store, and properly secured the canoe to Moe's roof. And while the worst possibilities seemed over, shattered yellow fiberglass, car crashes, manslaughter, the weather darkened considerably just 20 minutes later, and I found myself in near-blinding lightning storms. Also, the new straps, while tight, vibrated intensely from the vicious winds. Between their merciless buzz and the tormenting rain, the Jeep resounded more loudly than the interior of a prop plane. At times, the noise died down as I joined a stream of brake lights, cars inching through negligible visibility. At all speeds, I leaned into and over the steering wheel to eye patches of road while trying simultaneously to mark the exact position of the canoe's tip, still fearful that the new straps might fail. Lightning flashes, the rain. Over 4 hours later, I pulled over when my tank neared empty and the skies, too, had finally run dry. I remember closing my eyes at the gas pump, almost napping until the handle clicked. I wanted something warm to eat and staggered into a local pizza joint. A gal with freckled and milky skin and big teeth smiled from behind the register. From the highway, I hadn't noticed the name of the town. I didn't even know the state. "Where am I?" The gal beamed still wider. "Pizza Phil?" No, I said. "I mean, what town is this?" "Oh," she said slowly, "you're not from around here, are you?" I'd landed in Fishkill, New York, just 3 hours from home, and the rest of the drive was comparably easy, although I almost collapsed in our driveway. Still, I wanted to empty the Jeep right away, partly so I could return Mo to John and Deb, but mainly from a need of closure. I used the new straps to create hanging harnesses inside the carriage house, loops that cradled the canoe's yellow belly, its shape now appropriately righted. From a distance, it seemed to float in air. And after I had unpacked the wealth of my mother's art and my own few personal belongings, I indeed felt a sense of triumph and a huge swell of relief. I had survived the toughest drive of my life. Now was the time for contemplation. As Lawrence Blair said when returning to Bantu after the death of his brother, a trip that culminated in a ceremonial encounter with the royal family and a descent down a slope of loose stone, "It is these fragile communities that teach us that we must visit with care, and they remind us in turn that the pathway is both sacred and treacherous, and that it is worth paying attention to the now and to the rhythms of the present." Although my college had been in session for 2 weeks that fall, I had not truly found my teaching legs. My thoughts had kept returning to the forthcoming round trip, disbelieving my father's release of my mother's work and fretting about the mere practicalities of bringing it home. Would everything fit? Would work get damaged? I felt only partly focused on the now. My rhythms of the present had been shaken. Do we say closure when we mean focused rhythm? That night in bed, I thought, "Now I can start fresh. Tomorrow in the classroom, they'll have all of me." The following morning, I enjoyed the sunlight through my office windows, drank strong coffee, thought about locations for the newly returned art, and then turned to the poetry of William Carlos Williams and Langston Hughes to be discussed in the morning class. I felt focused and serene. But I'd fallen into the trap of thinking of time as merely cyclic, with the wheel of fortune turning in either one direction or another, rather than thinking of fate as a constant flux of fortune. I'd forgotten that Kali translates to both time and black. An hour later, two starships, one from each of the states where I was raised, New York and Massachusetts, blasted into Manhattan's skyline and brought the world to prayer. Thank you all for listening.